chatty and approachable and 60-plus, like your favorite crazy aunt. She was wearing salmon-colored jeans and a lot of bracelets. The thing with these pants is that they'll stretch a lot, so you really have to get them a size small, she offered. I took the jeans into a dressing room and put them on. I was stunned. They were super comfortable, they weren't too long, and the waist wasn't too short. It was a little high, to be honest. But for this kind of comfort and style, I was on board. I went back out and grabbed a few more pairs. Thank God I had decided to check out this mysterious jeans portal, I thought to myself. I handed four pairs over the counter to the woman in salmon pants. She found this to be a real hoot. I love it, she chirped. You're like, I'm getting my new jeans and I'm going to be comfortable and I'm going to look stylish while I'm doing it. Once again, I began to wonder where I was. Were these orthopedic jeans? Geriatric jeans? Pajama jeans? I stared at the label. NYDJ. Is that a Nordstrom brand? I asked hopefully. Oh, no. Not your daughter's jeans is a big, big brand, she explained. My stomach flipped. These were mom jeans. And not shameful mom jeans, but loud, proud, high-waisted, menopausal mom jeans. My excitement over finding jeans I temporarily liked quickly turned to despair. This is why I should always bring a shopping buddy with me, I thought, remembering the time I accidentally tried on men's underwear, don't ask. I'm still unclear whether the jeans actually looked decent or the hours of trying had scrambled my brain. I still have them. They're sitting in a bag in my closet, and I keep meaning to try them again and figure out whether to keep them, return them, or wear them in 30 years when they're age appropriate. In the meantime, I have this one pair I like. So the mom jeans sat in a Nordstrom bag in my closet for so long, and I kept thinking maybe I didn't know what to do. Like, and I was traveling for work a lot of the time, and I would always think, like, maybe I should bring them with me. Not all four pairs, just one pair. And then I thought, if they're not making the cut at home, they're not going to make the cut in Cincinnati. And then finally I returned them. But you know who's super into NYDJ jeans? My mom. Am I not first-class material? The illustration for this one is a boarding pass that says Allison Rosen, seat next to toilet, group steerage, and there's a chicken in the aisle of the plane. I recently flew to New York with the Adam Carolla Show to do some dates at Caroline's on Broadway. I intended to use the time in the air to get a bunch of work done. However, on the way to my seat, I discovered that my coworkers were sitting in first class while I was sitting in an overhead bin filled with crying children. So I had to spend the rest of the flight thinking about this injustice. Am I not first-class material? Am I not fit to enjoy hot nuts and ice cream sundaes and legroom? Do I not deserve to use the first-class bathroom, which is exactly the same as the ones in coach, but special because it's in the front? One of those coworkers was Adam Carolla, who was technically my boss, so it makes sense he'd fly in first. But the other coworker? He must have used his own money to upgrade to first. Unless there's some way he convinced the company to spring for the ticket. No, there's no way. It had to be his own money. But what if it wasn't? And so it went for 5 or so hours, give or take the part where two adorable twin Moppets with bronchitis coughed all over me while their mom quietly suggested they cover their mouth. It was vaguely thoughtful, but too late. Plus, a life in coach just isn't worth living. I think I read that in the in-flight magazine, so I didn't even try to dodge the sputum. I'd periodically gaze into first to see some flight attendant kneeling to have a heartfelt face-to-face with a valued passenger. If you ask for something in coach, they basically grimace and throw it at you. I bet they spoon-feed you in first. By the way, I'm not proud that I'm this petty. I would much prefer not to walk around noticing small inequalities, worrying I'm missing out on some better version of whatever I've received that I could have if only I could figure out how to crack the system. It's not my best quality. My best qualities? I'm funny, empathetic, compassionate, knowledgeable about eyeliner, and really good at that carnival game where you have to roll the bowling ball hard enough to get it to go over the first hump, but not so hard that it goes over the second, and I can read street signs from really far away. My worst qualities? I have no sense of direction. I'm conflict-averse, and I go nuts when it comes to planes and hotels, and apartments and where to sit at a restaurant. Want to know the first thing I do when I check into a hotel room? I ask for a better room. Hi, do you have a room in which it's possible to walk from one side to the other without having to climb over the bed? I'll demand, like some kind of celebutante or the Queen of England. In college, we had a thing at the end of every year called room draw, where each student was assigned a random number that determined their order for picking a room for the following year. If two people went in on a two-room double together, the one with the best number selected for the pair. If four went into a quad, an average of the numbers was taken. I remember a friend of mine saying the whole process felt like a calculus problem that, if figured out correctly, could somehow net her her own floor. That friend, for fans of my podcast, was Wendy Molyneux, and fans of Bob Burgers, where she's a writer. Too often, life is like this, and I get stuck puzzling over numbers and combinations instead of enjoying the experience or being in the moment. Granted, the flight to New York was a moment I didn't want to be in, but I still suspect I could have handled it in an easier, healthier way. I guess I'm sick. The illustration is a baby elephant lying on a bed with a blanket covering it. I am the kind of smug person who never gets sick, which is making the fact that I'm sick right now not only uncomfortable, but also baffling. What happened to my superior immune system, my ability to stare down the common cold, my talent for evading influenza? I sat next to a kid in fourth grade who had the chickenpox and didn't even get it. That's how much I don't get sick. If sickness had a wanted poster, it would have a picture of me on it. But today? Today I'm sick. So sick that I'm even thinking of recanting my position on those tissues with lotion in them. Spare me your slimy tissues, I used to announce, and keep your lozenges and Purell, too. When people would begin to detail the rituals they go through to avoid getting sick, my eyes would glaze over. I could achieve the same, and I didn't have to sleep with a humidifier, gargle echinacea, or waterboard myself with Emergen-C. I also didn't get a flu shot, since I hate shots. And before you wag your germy finger at me, I'll just point out that everyone I know is sick, and everyone I know gets flu shots. In fact, my mom got it first, and then my fiancé got it. And since I make out with both of them, it was only a matter of time. Wait, what? That's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say was because my mom and fiancé hadn't seen each other, but I had seen both of them, they decided that I was probably a carrier. I resented their attempts to play house. That's House, the TV show, not playing house. Plus, I found it insulting that they would blame me, the healthy person. Is this how you treat someone with a superhuman immune system? They should have been studying and celebrating me, not trying to bring me down to their level with accusations and finger-pointing. But it's moot, because I am now one of you, one of the coughing masses with a headache and a runny nose and sore throat and stomach ache and all over yucky feeling. And I'm so, so tired. Imagine an elephant that's been kept up for a week. That's how I feel. This isn't very flattering, but I'm just saying, I suspect it's hard to wake up an elephant once it's out. What do you use? A peanut on a stick? The real kick in the pants is that the plague from which I'm currently trying to recover set up camp on my days off after I returned from a work trip. My first thought was, I'm lucky I didn't get sick while working because that would have been difficult. I was quick to congratulate my traitorous immune system for, at the very least, its timing. But then I began to resent the fact that I would be spending my days off feeling like crud. I've had countless conversations with friends that go like this. Friend, I'm really sick. Me, maybe you should take a sick day. Friend, no way, I'm saving my sick days for something fun. So I guess I'm not alone in wishing I were sick on their time, not mine. The real question, though, is why now and why me? Did I need humbling? Was I flying too close to the sun? Was I shining a little too brightly? Was I making others feel less than? Yes to all of them, I hope. Was I flying too close to the sun? Was I shining a little too brightly? Was I making others feel less than? Yes to all of them, I hope. But if you think I'm going to have any sort of new attitude once I recover, if I recover, you're wrong. All I've learned is that flavorologists need to quit churning out new Oreos and instead turn their attention to cough syrup because holy hell, it's disgusting. The X Games. The illustration for this is a sign that says, danger, live minefield, keep out. I've never really felt self-conscious about having a small chest. It's not that I have a healthy body image. It's that I have an unhealthy one, and there are just so many other body parts to worry about that take priority. But I recently learned that my fiancé's former girlfriend had, let's just say, an ample bosom, and this information is doing all sorts of weird things in my head. For example, I wonder, when he hugs me, does it feel strange? When he spoons me as we sleep, is he thinking there's something missing? When he watches me walk, is there some kind of mental adjustment that must be done to account for lack of jiggle? And how come he never told me? I don't exactly know how he would have worked it into conversation, but still. Maybe that stuff mattered to me when I was a teenager, he tried to explain. But now it's about how I feel about a person, not how they look, he said, making it worse. How wonderful that you like me now that you no longer care about being with someone attractive, I harumphed. As a courtesy, I loudly explained to him what he should have said. The way I am is perfect to him, and he could never imagine wanting anyone else. He said this was true, that he thinks it's a given that I'm attractive, and he forgets that I forget. When people say what you tell them to say, it feels better than you'd think, but not as good as if they'd come up with it on their own. But, as I said, I've never really felt self-conscious about having a small chest. This is perhaps because large ones run in my family, and I've watched the kind of brassieres required to keep that situation looking perky. There's a whole lot of underwire and hooks and eyes and straps that dig in. I'm the kind of person who occasionally feels that bracelets are confining, who finds layers uncomfortably problematic if the seams don't line up or the sleeves aren't laying flat. So the less that squeezes and digs in and rumples or ripples, the better. Plus, as someone who grew up overweight and constantly feels there's a fat ghost over her shoulder ready to jump into her body and puff it up, I'm thankful for any part of me being small. To further drive the neurotic point home, occasionally, I don one of the aforementioned brassieres with the hydraulics and the padding and the lift and the separation, the kind of apparatus that's so uncomfortable I want to rip my hair out and hang myself with it, and then I look in the mirror and turn to the side and wonder whether the fantastic pseudo-boobs make me look fat. So here's the way I found out about the ex-bosoms. Fiancé and I were walking out of a store. I must interrupt myself to say, fiancé, 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 fiancé. Oh, my God. I am so sorry. Thank God we're finally married and I don't have to call him that anymore. Daniel and I were walking out of a store, and a woman passed us who was leggy and confident and walking with purpose, like someone in a deodorant commercial. I asked whether he saw her and said that's what I imagine his ex looks like. He asked whether I'd ever seen a picture of her, and I said no. I didn't tell him it wasn't for lack of trying. Apparently she's as private as I am public. I can't get a zit without recording a podcast and writing an article about it, but she isn't even on Facebook. He said she had a different build than the woman who passed us. I think he intended for that to make me feel better, but I'm more skilled at this game than he is, so I was able to see his "she had wider hips" and raise it to, "oh, did she have a big chest?" He squirmed a little before answering. I felt bad that I was grilling him. It wasn't coming from a place of jealousy so much as curiosity. But the more he hesitated to tell me about her chest, the more it seemed like he thought this was something that would bump me. And the more he seemed to think it would bump me, the more I wondered whether it should. This brings us to today. I'm still wondering how to feel about it. I suppose it doesn't really matter because his past is his past, and how I feel about it won't change anything. But still. Post-traumatic electric bill syndrome. The illustration is a thermostat that's set to 70 degrees. I've decided instead of referring to him as my fiancé, I'm just going to call him by some guy's name. It might be Daniel, it might be something else. Last night, Sven did something that tested the limits of my love for him and caused me to wonder whether our entire relationship is built on a foundation of lies. I'm talking about a transgression so great I never could have seen it coming because I'd never expect this kind of monstrous act from someone I trust, like Sven. Or rather, trusted. He turned off the air conditioning. I stared at him like he was insane. I tried to talk sense into him, but he couldn't hear me over the sweat pooling in his ears. And then he made an announcement that will haunt me till the end of my days, that functioned like a shot across the bow and should have been made in a beer hall. From now on, let's try not to run the air conditioning and instead open the windows, he said. I've never felt less attracted to someone. The way I see it, outside is hot and unpleasant and full of bugs. Inside is cool and pleasant and full of Twitter and cable TV. Killing the air conditioning is bad enough, but why would you then go and remove the one thing that keeps the outside out and the inside in? Why not just invite a rapist over for dinner, or drive the wrong way down a one-way street, or dip yourself in honey, roll yourself in bacon, and hang out in an area heavily populated by bears while doing things known to anger them, like poking them, making comments about their women, or yelling, "Aha, I knew it," when they relieve themselves in the woods? I mean, I do understand where this god-awful idea comes from. It's post-traumatic stress from the sight of our last electric bill. Turns out cooling our apartment costs roughly the same as sending a small child to private school. But we don't yet have any small children, and we never will if this continues. In this heat, the feeling of my flesh touching itself is enough to make me nuts, let alone the feeling of someone else's. But I'm not one to complain, as you can probably tell, and so far, I've discovered that if I either stand still or stand still in front of the open refrigerator and freezer, it isn't so bad. The food is rotting, but there are casualties in all wars. The challenge to living without air conditioning is moving around, showering, doing anything more to my hair than wrapping a symbolic white towel around it, and, of course, sleeping. It's impossible to sleep without a lot of cold air blowing on me, which is confounding on many levels. The heat makes me sleepy, but unable to actually sleep. If you're looking for a way to wake up angry, cranky, and frizzy, I recommend turning off the air conditioning. It occurs to me that in a way, I'm extorting money from Sven by becoming so unpleasant and shiny that he'll be left with no choice but to turn on the air conditioning. That's the goal, at least. When I was pregnant, there was a huge heat wave, and there was a blackout, and we lost electricity for, I don't know, like half a day maybe, during which time I had to record my podcast, and awesome producer Jeff was able somehow to still record the episode, which would be recorded by candlelight. But it was very hot, very uncomfortable, and then the power came back on, but our air conditioning did not. And I was in the beginning of pregnancy when you're the most sick. And Daniel, or Sven, as the case may be, who grew up in Tucson, was like kind of made uncomfortable by this situation, but could deal with it. I was despondent. I nearly lost my mind. It was as if a calamity had visited our apartment, which it had. Thankfully, we got it working again, but I still fear it going out. About that time, I test drove a car into another car. The illustration for this one is a backup camera. It says check surroundings carefully, and there's a car extremely close to the car that this backup camera is in. Something horrible happened to me at a car dealership, and I'm not just talking about the experience of being at a car dealership. No, I'm talking about something so awful, embarrassing, confidence-crushing, and possibly criminal that I intended to leave the dealership and never speak of it again. I then planned to change my name and number, leave my loved ones, and live out my days in a small yurt in Central Asia, far away from cars and the people who sell them. But that seems like a lot of work, and I'm kind of lazy, not to mention really bad at secrets. So here I am, humbly asking that you not judge me for what I'm about to reveal. Recently, while test driving a brand new car, I kinda sorta backed into another brand new car. Allow me to explain. I'd been car shopping for a while, and I was pretty familiar with the whole test drive rigmarole. I expected this one to be no different than the others. I would show up, make awkward small talk with someone who is curiously unable to answer the most basic questions about options and packages, go on a comically short drive around the dealership, hitting a max speed of about 30 miles per hour, be pressured into sitting at a desk and talking numbers, even though I'm not ready to make a decision, and then receive a call from this person between 2 and 5 times a week for the rest of my life. Also, I'd catch a whiff of the dealer's cologne and wonder for the rest of the day how he could have so strongly imbued the air around my nose with his scent, which feels like an aromatic violation in such a short time. So, Jürgen, mind you, I'm no longer using the word fiancé. I'm replacing it with a man's name each time. It seems to be men of a Nordic persuasion today. And did I say Jürgen? I meant Jürgen. Jürgen and I show up at the dealership on this day, and instead of making a copy of my license, the dealer literally throws me a set of keys, like we're buddies in a cop movie, and says, "Let's drive." The car I'm test driving is brand new, so new that all the upholstery still has plastic film covering. I assume the dealer will remove it so I can experience the car without feeling like I'm driving Dexter's kill room, but he doesn't. It's a bit of a dated reference. It's to the show Dexter. After the aforementioned short, slow test drive, we drive back onto the lot. My explanation of the Dexter aside, I realize, did not help you at all. It was sort of like in the early days of blogs, when my friend Yami said to me, "What does blog stand for?" And I said, "It's short for weblog," which still didn't answer her question. Anyway, when Dexter would murder someone, he had this very meticulous way of covering, and he only murdered bad people. He was a sociopath, but like on a mission for good. So he would take out horrible people, but he would coat the whole area with plastic and make sure that he left no trace. After the aforementioned short, slow test drive, we drive back onto the lot. Instead of saying, "Just stop anywhere and I'll park it," as I've come to expect, he suggests I back it into any available space so I can experience the backup camera. "Are you sure?" I ask more than once. "Sure," he trills, "if you're comfortable with it." I'm not really, but I defer to his can-do attitude, deciding in that moment that I've been selling myself short. Who knows how many experiences and opportunities I've missed out on because I'm holding myself back. Well, no more. Yesterday's me wouldn't park the car, but today's me, she's parking. "Actually, why don't you back it into that one up there?" he says, pointing to a smaller and narrower space a little further down. "Then you can see the car side by side last year's model." This is definitely a bad idea, but his positive attitude is so contagious. As I back into the space, a parking maneuver I never use in real life, as will soon be apparent, I look at the backup camera with all its lines and squiggles. Indecipherable. Then I look up to make sure I'm not too close to the car in front of me, which doesn't even make sense. And then I hear the sickening sound of metal scraping on metal. "Did I just hit a car?" I ask, as if through a mouthful of vomit. "Yes," say both the dealer and Jürgen. Now look, obviously I'm the one piloting the car like a drunk four-year-old, but how did the other two people in the vehicle, who presumably were witnessing the slow-speed collision, not give me a heads-up or a warning or a, "Hey, you're about to hit that car"? "You seemed awfully close, but I thought you knew what you were doing," said Jürgen. I responded, "I never know what I'm doing. Never assume I know what I'm doing." Then the dealer piped up, "Don't worry about it. I didn't see anything. I promise. I didn't see anything." I gingerly got out of the car. I looked around for cameras, convinced I was about to be arrested. Then I thought about how frequently these cars are driven. "This must happen a lot, right?" I asked, hopefully. "Actually, this is only the second time it's happened in 10 years, the dealer chirped. He asked us to come back to his desk and have a seat. On the way, he got pulled aside to deal with another customer, at which point I realized that I pretty much had to leave right then because nothing good was going to happen if I stuck around. I hastily made up a reason why I had to leave, but gave the dealer my phone number. He called me once, and I nearly wet myself when I saw his number pop up on my phone. But he was just curious whether I was interested in the car, which I wasn't. He didn't say anything about a you-break-it-you-buy-it policy, which is what I was afraid of. I mostly take this experience as a sign the universe wants me to be chauffeured. I was so nervous, and I remember we came back in and we sat down, and then the dealer went to go have some conversation with someone else real fast, and he was going to come back. And I remember saying to Daniel / Jürgen, "We have to go. We have to go now." Because I was like, I'm just repeating myself, but nothing good is going to come from us staying here. But then I was so worried about it. I think someone told me that they have insurance to cover these kinds of things, but still. So yeah, for someone who wants to be chauffeured as much as I do, you'd think that I would use like Lyft more often than I do. I do use it sometimes. Mostly I use it if I'm going somewhere where I don't want to deal with the hassle of having to park. But one of the things I liked about living in New York was not needing to have a car. Okay, then. Clutter, memory, and the junk in my car. The illustration of this one is a sunset and a small plane, like riding into the sunset. Yesterday I sold the car I've had and hated for the last 15 years. Instead of feeling relieved and happy, like I would have expected, I just feel numb, weird, and a little empty. It's not that I miss that hunk of metal with its fading paint, steering wheel the size of a small hula hoop, and top-of-the-line single CD player. On the contrary, I'm happy to be free of those things. It's just that after 15 years, I formed a relationship. with the car, an unhealthy and annoying one, the kind your friends tell you to get out of, and apparently it got under my skin. I wish I were one of those people who embraced change. If I were, I would be sipping tea in Jakarta and running my fingers through my freshly cropped hair while waiting for Ernesto, the man who's helping me get my pilot license and with whom I'm having a tour at a fair, to arrive and whisk me away for an afternoon of flight lessons and romance. "Don't get attached, Ernesto," I'd murmur at 20,000 feet. At that height, he probably wouldn't hear me, though, so I'd have to yell it. "Don't get attached, Ernesto," I'd yell. "Don't touch the latch," he'd ask. If we didn't meet an untimely demise in a fiery crash due to me trying to warn him I'm no good, then I'd likely break his heart later when I'd pick up and move to another exotic locale. And change my hair again, as is my way. I wish I were like that, capricious and whimsical. Instead, I'm a flightless creature of habit with the same hairstyle since high school and a penchant for clutter. You know those people who can't make attachments? Those people who can love and leave, pick up and go, cut and run? Rambling men, mostly? I'm the opposite. It's as if my heart is made of suction cups and my hands are lint rollers and the rest of my body is made of something else very sticky. Velcro. Balloons. Dog noses. And so I become a little attached to anything I come in contact with. It's for this reason I have trouble throwing things away. I'm an emotional hoarder. And possibly a regular hoarder. Part of the emotional wallop of saying goodbye to the car I longed to be rid of was cleaning it out before the buyer came. It was very similar to that feeling you always have when moving, looking around at a place that is so imbued with you and thinking, in just 24 hours this will no longer look like this and it will no longer be mine. And your mind reels at how this can be, not to mention the fact that you should have started packing weeks ago. And then the process of moving in and getting comfortable is experienced in reverse as you begin taking things off the walls and putting all your belongings in boxes. By the time the moving men come the next day, the apartment no longer looks like the place you knew, the place where you experienced all the memories that came flooding back to you as you were packing. It looks the same as when you moved in, cold and impersonal, as if you'd never been there. It's all kind of jarring. I bought the car in 1998, shortly after a friend died. I was deeply in mourning, and that sadness always clung to the car. As I was cleaning it out, I found all sorts of stuff from that time of my life. A birth announcement for my friend's daughter, who's now a teenager. A laminate for the 5th anniversary party of the magazine where I worked. Stickers and flyers for the band I played in. At the time, I didn't know what to do with myself or my stuff, so I stashed it in my car and tried not to feel anything. As the family who bought the car was driving away, I stood at the window watching, thinking it would be the last time I saw the car, so I ought to commit it to memory. After about 10 minutes, the car came back to return the sunglasses I'd left inside. They were sunglasses I didn't want, ones that I bought while in the depths of mourning when I was having trouble not bursting into tears. I think there's a lesson in here about clutter and memory and the passage of time, and maybe about what happens when you don't finish processing everything. The truth is, I'm still trying to figure it out. Employment History, Volume 1. The illustration is a cat sitting next to a Starbucks cup. In honor of recently celebrating Labor Day, I thought I'd take a look back at some of the highlights of my rich work history. But then I realized I'd rather look at the lows, as there are more of them, and frankly, I think I'm still pissed. In high school, my friend Jen referred me for a babysitting job. One young kid, convenient location, good hours. I was surprised she didn't want it for herself, and soon I found out why. Shortly after meeting the adorable toddler and his mother, who needed someone to watch him while she had permanent makeup tattooed on her face, which I assume was a response to an acrimonious divorce, I discovered the kid had two pastimes about which he was equally passionate, Barney and Friends, and biting people. To be honest, this wasn't the first time I'd been bitten by a child. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, and Jaws was all the rage, my family took a trip to Lake Tahoe. As so often happens when you're a kid, I began playing with the other children at the swimming pool. Have you noticed that dogs gravitate toward one another and children gravitate toward one another, but adults do not? It's curious. Soon, one of the kids put her hands above her head to approximate a fin, hummed the Jaws theme, and chomped down on my shoulder. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I had relevant experience for this particular job. Worse than the biting, though, was the Barney. It's been over 20 years, but just typing the words has put the song back in my head. And just saying them now, it's back in my head. Soon after, I began working as a greeter at the defunct music store Sam Goody. Theoretically, this involved saying, "Hi, welcome to Sam Goody," as people entered, and "Bye, thank you for shopping at Sam Goody," as they left. But in reality, it meant shouting, "Hi, welcome to," and "Bye, thank you for," at people's backs. It also involved an aggressive pat-down every time you left the store, and a manager who repeatedly admonished, "Allison, help the customers," even though they'd already declined my little help. "Ask them again," she'd hiss. Frankly, between being accosted by a manic greeter and being asked repeatedly whether you need help finding anything, shopping at Sam Goody was probably an unpleasant experience. I'd like to think I had a hand in that. Fast forward a great many years, through working at a coffee cart that required me to wear white, the hardest color to keep clean and the most difficult substance to keep off your clothing, or maybe I'm just messy, interviewing men dressed up as giant vegetables, working for an editor who demanded to know how many pounds of tomatoes are used a year by all the chefs in New York City, when I tried to explain why it's impossible to ascertain this number at 5 p.m. on a Friday, I was seen as difficult, an injustice that to this day makes me want to throw a shoe, dancing on live TV and a brief experience with temping. About that effing tomato situation? I am still pissed. To me, that was such a fool's errand, and that was such a just like, you have to do this because I say you have to do this. Which is really part of every job, I guess, but it's the part I like least. About the temp job. I started on Monday and called in sick on Wednesday and quit on Friday. I never quite understood what it was the company did, partly because I was warned by a woman who wrote her name all over her chair in whiteout not to ask too many questions. I think it had something to do with list maintenance for a company that sent spam. I remember sitting down at the desk of the woman who was to train me and noticing her computer was festooned with pictures of a calico cat. I held off asking the cat's name because I wanted to ration out possible conversation topics. I later found out it was named Venti because she, quote, loved Starbucks. She handed me a few sheets of paper stapled together titled Rules for Doing Something or Other. "This is basically what we do here," she said, running her hand over the outline. I seriously considered the possibility that what we do here was make outlines. And then some tall guy with floppy hair entered the building, and all the women swooned. His name was Blaine. He did Tai Chi in the park, and he'd designed the barely functioning software we use to maintain the lists. In my brief tenure, I would be told no less than 17 times that Blaine designed the software, each time the person giving a faraway look that began to frighten me. But the real problem was there were two of us assigned to do the job of half a monkey, and the boredom was soul-crushing. Up to this point, I'd wondered where the jobs were that paid you to sit around doing nothing. I'd found one, and I hated it. Upon reflection, I fear I come off as an asshole with a poor work ethic, which I assure you is a mischaracterization, never mind that I characterized myself. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to perform a Barneyectomy on myself before I walk into traffic. That temp job that I had for a handful of days, that whole experience is so surreal to me. First of all, you had to get up very, very early. And this was a partying time of my life. New York bars are open till 4. And I had come from California where they're not open till 4. And I was a late bloomer and I was kind of making up for lost time. And I was going out a lot and having a lot of fun. And then I got called by this temp agency at like 4:50 in the morning of a night that I'd been out late. I think I was probably still. I wasn't even hungover yet. I was just drunk. And asked if I could come in that morning early. And I did. So I was like not fully lucid, and it was very early. I didn't have enough sleep. And the whole thing was just so weird. There was just this whole ethos of don't ask questions. Just do what you're told to do. But I kind of need a, it'd be like if someone was teaching you to tie a shoe, but never explained you're tying a shoe. It was just like, we make this loop here, and then we wrap this around. And that, you know, some people maybe that would be fine for them. I'm a bigger picture kind of person. Okay. I'm turning into a dog pageant mom. The illustration is a cute little dog. It's like a Pomeranian wearing a skirt and a tiara. My dog has tested out of level 1 agility and into level 2, which means 2 things. I'm very proud of him, and I'm worried I'm going to become one of those people. In case you're unfamiliar with the notion of those people, they're the ones who get so sucked into a way of life they cease to have any self-awareness or shame. I'm reminded of the time Friedrich bought us season passes to Disneyland. We just have to be careful we don't become those people, I whispered as a couple in matching denim shirts with Mickey and Minnie patches walked by. Some other people I don't want to become? The people who talk your ear off about Pilates. The people who enjoy line dancing. The people who scrapbook. The people who knit. The people who are obsessed with Harry Potter or Twilight. And the people who are afraid of their microwave. Lest you are one of these people and feel judged, let me remind you that for a good year, I was obsessed with the Panda Cam, and I recently enrolled in a frozen dinner rewards program through which, if I play my cards right, I might get a set of matching mugs. Speaking of cards, one of my greatest regrets is that I've never been able to pull off any sort of fancy card shuffling. You know that move where you're shuffling and you pull your hands apart and then slam them back together and the cards look like an accordion? I tried to master that till my fingers were raw. So what I'm saying is, I'm not exactly cool either. But back to those people. I'm destined to become one because I come from a long line of them. My dad collects stamps. He tried to instill a passion for philately in his children, but it never stuck. My sister and her husband collect squish pennies and keep them in a special squish penny holder. And my mom, though svelte, knows everything there is to know about jelly beans. It's only natural I become an enthusiast. Maybe I shouldn't fight it. The way dog agility works is there are all sorts of obstacles set up in the room, ramps and tunnels and hurdles and whatnot, and as a class, you take turns leading your dog through the individual obstacles. At the end, you put it all together. Some dogs stop halfway up a ramp, refuse to go through a tunnel, or go around the hurdle instead of over. Other dogs, like mine, though younger and littler than the rest, take to it instantly and are fearless and really seem to enjoy it. This elicits a ton of praise from the instructors, which fills empty spots in me I didn't know I had. After class, my dog and I walk around puffed up and proud of ourselves. People compliment my dog, and I accept the compliments as if I gave birth to him or had anything to do with his unusual talent. And then we come home, he takes a nap, and I look at him and smile and fantasize about ribbons. What has become of me? Thankfully, there are little impediments along the way that will hopefully prevent me from turning into a full-fledged dog pageant mom. For example, everyone at the dog gym, yes, you read that right, where I take Oliver, wears a fanny pack filled with treats. They refer to these as feed bags, but to my eyes, they are fanny packs. Mine is not a fanny enhanced by the addition of a pack, so I carry treats around in a Ziploc bag, and once a class, I accidentally drop the bag and all the treats spill on the floor. I guess I'll be getting a fanny pack, because I'm one of those people now. I can't stop thinking about crying baby elephants. The image for this one is Dumbo as a baby. Cute baby Dumbo. You know that feeling when there's something delicious in your house that you're trying not to eat, but you can't get it out of your head? Eventually, you get to a point where you realize you either have to eat it or throw it out because you won't get any peace as long as it's around. Please tell me you relate, even if it's a lie. This is how I feel right now, only it isn't a forbidden carbohydrate that's calling my name. It's a link I'm trying not to click. Specifically, it's the one that will take me to the news story currently making the rounds on the internet about a baby elephant in China that cried for 5 hours after being attacked and rejected by its mother. You may have already seen or heard about it. All I know is I went to sleep one night blissfully unaware that elephants produce tears and woke up to nonstop baby elephant chatter. If I had a nickel for every well-meaning person who emailed or tweeted me the link, I'd have close to a dollar. You know, we really need to adjust that phrase for inflation. The point is, I don't want to read this story. I don't want to feel the sadness it will make me feel. You know that scene in Dumbo where he's a baby and his mother is rocking him in her trunk and everyone is crying, especially me? That scene wrecked me. Years of therapy can't remove that image from my memory, and it wasn't even real. Okay, fine. I just clicked the link. I couldn't help myself. I'm powerless in the face of baby animals that are experiencing strong emotions. And then I told myself that I definitely wasn't going to try to find video footage of the crying elephant while trying to find video footage of the crying elephant because I was curious as to what an elephant's wail sound like. Apparently, seeing a photo of its puffy red eyes and wet trunk wasn't enough. But what if the video contains footage of the mother stomping the baby, I wondered. A nervous flutter went through me. Most of me didn't want to see that, but there was a tiny bit of me that was sort of curious, and I'm disturbed that part is in me. Mercifully, I didn't find anything. I'm confused by this compulsion to watch and read things that will make me experience a cocktail of emotions I'm trying to avoid. I think on some level I actually do want to feel these feelings, ones I'm repressing in my daily life, and these stories act like little emotional release valves. The other day, I thought it would be a good idea to watch videos of people with cochlear implants hearing for the first time after a lifetime of deafness. Have you seen these videos? Instant tears. I don't mean the kind of thing where you see it and then think about it for a second and then tear up. I mean you're watching and the person in the video starts crying, and before you can even process what's happening, you're a puddle. I've always somewhat harshly judged the people who enjoy brutal, gruesome, or excessively violent videos and movies. I'm talking about the people who love torture porn franchises like Saw or Hostel and pass around YouTube videos of beheadings and, to a lesser degree, the Tosh.0 audience that enjoys countless clips of people falling and getting hurt. And nowadays on Instagram, there's a very popular account called something like Kids Getting Hurt, and it's like just kids falling over. And a whole bunch of people that I'm sure you know follow it and think it's amusing, and I don't. To my imagination, these viewers are watching and either feeling nothing or worse, laughing at the misfortune of others. I'm beginning to wonder whether I haven't judged them too harshly. Maybe they aren't bloodless automatons, but people playing their own version of emotional Russian roulette, trying to see how much they can tolerate. Maybe they're afraid of their own emotional reactions and trying to practice tamping them down, an understandably desirable skill in a culture that values stoicism. To be clear, watching videos and movies with which you identify and empathize, we're all that baby elephant, is not the same as watching something in which the victim is objectified. But I'm beginning to wonder whether the desire to view both doesn't come from a similar place inside, trying to learn to release and restrict our own unmanageable emotions. So this whole, I'm not going to click that, I'm not going to watch that thing, intent, the thing that I've had for a long time, because basically I have a rule, which is I don't Google or watch things that will scare me because I'm way too sensitive. After I had a baby, it blossomed and intensified and a dark thought would pop into my head and I would be like, don't Google that, don't Google that, don't Google that. And I found it, like usually I'm pretty good with just, okay, I just have made the decision that I will not Google that. I will not Google stuff about animal experimentation or things that I know are just going to get under my skin and stick with me. And I'm not saying I advocate living in ignorance. I'm just saying I advocate being informed, and at the same time, if you know yourself and you know what's going to shatter your peace of mind, I think it's worthwhile to try to preserve your peace of mind. So anyway, I found it much harder to not give in to the urge to Google. And that encouraged me to get back into therapy, which I recommend if you're considering it. When hair dryers attack, the illustration is a door being opened and a hair dryer coming in as if attacking you. The other day, my hair dryer attacked me, which is the closest thing to a loved one's betrayal I've ever experienced. Here's what happened. Like all reasonable women, I have two hair dryers. There's the expensive heavy one, which must somehow work better because I paid so much for it, and the cheapo portable one I bought at the drugstore, which is my emergency backup and travel dryer. To spice things up and infuse some whimsy into my otherwise predictable life, one day at home, I decided to dry my hair with the cheapo one, just to keep my hair guessing. I was kind of blown away by how well it worked, no pun intended. Don't tell Vidal, but I dare say I preferred it to the other one. And then something happened. I typically leave it out when telling this story. However, I will tell you because I think you deserve the whole truth. As regular readers know, I have an adorable dog. What you don't know is he loves the hairdryer. When I use it, he sits at my feet, basking in the stream of air. I think he likes the warmth. It's also possible he just hates the natural look. So after blowing dry my hair and observing the aforementioned improved volume and shine, I pointed the dryer at my dog and we cavorted in our usual way, him facing the stream of air and doing this thing where he tips his head up and squints, which looks like he's either farting or smiling, while I repeatedly ask, "Who's a good boy?" Hint, he is. So, you know, earlier I said that rereading these stories has brought some memories that I'd forgotten about of Oliver back to me, which I love. I had forgotten that he loved the hairdryer. Then I worried, as I always do, that maybe the air is too warm, even though he seems to like it. So I thought I'd press the cool shot button. I'm pretty sure this would be the first time in the history of hair drying someone has deliberately sought out this button. For those unfamiliar, the cool shot button is a button that, in the fantasy world of hair dryer literature, the literature you find on the box the dryer came in and in women's magazines, helps you, quote, lock in style with a blast of cool air. In the real world of my bathroom, this button doesn't lock in anything other than an extra 10 minutes of my time. If you ever find yourself thinking, "Why is this hairdryer making a lot of noise, but no heat is coming out and my hair isn't getting dry?" congrats, you've found the cool shot button. The annoying thing about the button, other than the fact that it doesn't work, is it's always right where your hand naturally rests while holding the dryer, so it's easy to accidentally press. At least, that's the case with my expensive dryer. I was having trouble finding it on the cheapo one, so I flipped the dryer around to get a good look. I was leaning forward over the dryer, and the dryer was in my right hand. Suddenly, I felt a tug on the right side of my head. It was sucking in my hair. My hair was wrapped around the spinning fan inside the contraption, and more was being pulled in. I tried to turn the dryer off, but because I don't use it frequently, I accidentally pushed the button as far as it would go, from low to off to high. The dryer roared and pulled my hair in faster. Panicked, I pushed the slider back in the other direction, high to off to low. This wasn't going as planned. The third attempt worked, and I managed to turn it off. And then, with one hand holding the dryer, since letting go would mean the weight of the dryer yanking my hair out, I went to the mirror to appraise the damage. It was as I expected. My hand was attached to the dryer, which was attached to my hair, which was attached to my head. I reached across my face and grabbed the dryer with my left hand and tried to loosen the hair with my right since I'm right-handed. I couldn't see over my arms. I was like a one-person game of human versus hairdryer twister. The hair wasn't budging. I grabbed the nearest scissors, manicure scissors, and debated cutting myself free. I was hot and sweaty and panicked, and the dryer, ironically light and flimsy, was beginning to feel like an anchor. I decided I wasn't ready to resort to such a drastic measure. I tried to slip the manicure scissors off my fingers, but then I realized they were stuck. I felt like a giant trapped in a 6-pound bowling ball. And now I couldn't even call anyone because one hand was holding the dryer and the other looked like the last prop made by a hard-of-hearing prop master on Edward Scissorhands shortly before he was fired. I finally pried the scissors off by using the edge of the counter. I then did something handy, found a screwdriver, and using my left hand, unscrewed all four screws holding the dryer together. It took quite a bit longer than you might expect, since righty-tighty, lefty-loosey loses all meaning in a mirror. And then I tried to pull the hairdryer open to save my precious tresses, but it wouldn't budge. I'd spent what felt like an hour unscrewing the damn thing, but its molded plastic body wasn't opening. And that's when I gave up, imprisoned my fingers in the scissors once more, and cut myself free. I'm not sure who to blame for the fiasco, but I'm open to suggestions. I still have this hairdryer. In fact, just last night when I was going to reach for my... There's a new dryer in the mix. When I was going to reach for that one, I saw this one and I thought about how I loved this dryer, this like cheapo dryer that I got at a drugstore, but I'm afraid to use it. And also I never screwed the back on after I unscrewed it. I should probably throw it out because it's been a while. Probably not going to use it. Candy Crushed. The illustration for this one is a woman who is supposed to be my sister, and her eyes and nose are made of candy. I should probably delete Candy Crush from my phone. I'm not going to, but I probably should. Here's why. The other day, while having a conversation with my sister, I found myself wishing I could reach across the space between us, place my index finger on her left eye and my thumb on her right eye, and squished them together until they exploded and disappeared. Sadly, this isn't even a move in Candy Crush, though it's similar to one. For it to really work, her eyes would have to be made of candy, and she would need to have at least three. I also long to group trees, cars, and buildings into groups of three or, be still my heart, groups of four, and slam them together to make them disappear. It's not that I'm destructive, it's that I'm obsessed. For the uninitiated, Candy Crush, or Candy Crush Saga, its full name, is a super popular game that its makers refer to as, quote, an addictive and delicious puzzle adventure. It's made by King.com, a British company that's currently the top supplier of games to Facebook and Apple. It surpassed Zynga, maker of Words with Friends and other popular games, in June, and is worth somewhere between $5 billion and $7 billion. Mind you, this is now a little bit dated. Who knows what it's worth now? Actually, did they have some scandal? Now I'm going to have to look that up. Hold, please. Yes, they were accused of copying another game. I don't know what came of it, though. I'm not really a big video game person or puzzle person. In fact, I can think of nothing more deadly boring than a big jigsaw puzzle spread out in a zillion pieces on an empty table. To me, jigsaw puzzles have always been something you do to pass the time when you have absolutely zero better options. I can imagine someone saying, "You guys go ahead to prom. I'll just stay here and work on this 1,000-piece puzzle of a kitten," I can imagine someone saying. Or, "No, you guys go ahead to the amusement park. I'm under house arrest and the electricity has gone out, so I'm going to drink cold postum and work on this 2,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of a dandelion." Or, "Hot air ballooning? I couldn't possibly go hot air ballooning with you. I'm paralyzed from the waist down and have contracted scabies, so I'm just going to stay home, break in these new pajamas, scratch myself, and put the finishing touches on this 3,000-piece puzzle of, get this, a hot air balloon." In terms of time wasters, I'm more of an 80s sitcom and mess around on Twitter person. Sometimes I'll spend an hour or two looking for something I've misplaced, but at some point while hearing my fiancé talk to my mom about how much money makers of Candy Crush have raked in and how he refuses to download the app because he's convinced it's somehow so persuasive that it convinces otherwise sensible people to part with tons of money to keep playing, I decided I would take that challenge. It's sort of the online equivalent of being compelled to take a drug after watching an after-school special. So far, I haven't fallen into financial ruin or sold an organ on the black market to keep playing. The only negative consequence of allowing Candy Crush into my life, I mean, other than wanting to squish my sister's eyes, is that it's functioning like a gateway drug and I need something stronger. Candy is dandy, but strip clubs and murder might be more my speed. Do I dare dip a toe into the world of Grand Theft Auto 5? My coworkers have discussed looking at their calendars and making sure they didn't have anything they really needed to get done before purchasing the game. Unfortunately, once again, I see this as a challenge. Other than a ton of work and planning a wedding, I think I'm wide open. So, talk to you in a few months? I never did get into Grand Theft Auto 5. I think I did try to play it once. I think I'm just not a video game person, although I did enjoy Candy Crush. I haven't played it in a really long time. But for the time I was into it, I was happy to have the distraction. I also tried to get into video games again after Oliver died, because I'm like, I need something immersive that will distract me. I need an escape. and it didn't really work. Sleepless in Portland. The illustration is of two big dishes like you'd see at a buffet, and they both have the same items in them, with tongs in them as well, and one says pancakes and the other says smoked salmon. Have you ever had one of those days where you're convinced you didn't sleep a wink and the only way you know you actually did is because you dreamed? And not even about anything cool, like finding a door that leads to a roller coaster in the back of your closet, but about something prosaic, like trying to find a parking spot. That's the kind of night I had recently at an exceedingly hip hotel in Portland, Oregon, which, decor-wise, was somewhere between dorm room, white-collar prison, and depressing flop house that men who are going through a divorce in their 50s move into. The room had a mattress a few inches off the floor, a sink a few inches from the bed, high ceilings, a molded plastic chair, paper-thin walls, and a record player. Lord knows only maniacs would dream of traveling without their vinyl collection. It also had small-batch artisanal everything, including soda made with real cane sugar in the minibar. This really bummed me out. I would have killed for a Diet Coke. Anyway, for whatever reason, and I'm not saying it was the 5 cups of coffee I drank to get my energy up before performing with Adam Carolla at the Aladdin Theater that evening, I tossed and turned all night, woke up in the worst mood ever, and began to despair over how I was possibly going to drag myself through the next few days. If you are in that phase of life during which sleep comes easy but is somewhat optional, take advantage of it. Stay awake from ages 19 to 23 because no one tells you that one day you won't feel like yourself for at least a year, possibly two, because you made the mistake of taking a red eye. I used to pull all-nighters by choice. It was my preferred method for meeting deadlines. And then I'd sleep for a couple hours, wake up refreshed, and go about my day. I was so springy in my youth. Now I'm brittle and cranky. It takes me longer and longer to wake up and longer to go to sleep. Eventually I'll just wake up and begin getting ready for bed. About that, that is one of the few, I think, arguments in favor of having kids young. When you have them old like I did, it's just so exhausting. I mean, I think it's exhausting to have a newborn no matter what, but there are plenty of times where I'm on the floor with my baby and then I get up and I'm like, well, I'm going to feel that tomorrow. And that's an old person thing to say. Back to Portland, where I picked myself up off the floor, took a lukewarm shower in a clawfoot bathtub, washed my hair with what I'm pretty sure was body wash, and then made my way down to the breakfast room. A word about clawfoot tubs. I realize they're kitschy and cool, but I'm never excited to use one. And conversely, I've never seen a big modern shower and found myself disappointed with the ease with which I would be bathing. I was hoping to grab some coffee to go, but they didn't have to-go cups. As I was processing this news, I ran into Adam, or at least I think it was him. On a good day, it now takes a while for my eyes to adjust, but this wasn't a good day. I faced the familiar human-shaped blur in front of me and tried to focus. I felt as if I'd been packed in rock salt and left to brine overnight. My eyelids were so puffy, I may as well have been looking through two bagels. Then I tried to speak, but my voice sounded like the noise that comes out of one of those big coffee thermoses when it's empty and you tip it forward and pump desperately. Did you sleep? I didn't sleep, I bleated. There was a time when I wished to come across as a little more easygoing and delightful, but now I was just angry that the hotel didn't provide box springs. I surveyed the food-shaped blobs in front of me. Adam warned me that what he mistook for, quote, pancake shards were actually slices of smoked fish. I felt better knowing I wasn't the only one whose senses waited a solid few hours to kick in. After eating everything that wasn't nailed down, the only way to survive a sleepless night, drinking too much coffee and taking a 2-hour nap, which really meant an hour and 50 minutes of playing Candy Crush, setting my alarm for 10 minutes and then getting under the covers and closing my eyes, I began to feel more like myself. And sadly, by that I mean feel old. The Worst Kind of Flirt. The illustration is two buttons. And they're both Michael Jackson, and one is Michael Jackson Bad Era, and one is Beat It, Michael Jackson. There are world-class flirts, and then there are world-class flirts. I'm not one of them. I'm regional at best, and a very small region at that, like my house. I was thinking about this recently because I had an interaction with someone who's known in my circle to be the kind of guy who everyone, women, men, married women and men, household pets, has crushes on. I'd met him before and had some brief interactions, but I never quite understood what all the fuss was about. He struck me as warm and cute, but loads of people fit that description. That was before a recent exchange where, in the course of talking to me, he grabbed the tip of my index finger gently between his thumb and index finger, held it for a few seconds, looked into my eyes, and said, "I know," in response to something I'd said. It was the strangest gesture. Who grabs the tip of